Welcome to the Mindful Living Podcast. I'm your host, Athea Davis. Are you ready to become the person everyone loves, including yourself? Imagine being filled with purpose, joy, and focused energy every single day. I guide kids to gain their inner calm and adults to spark their inner child. Each week, I will give you fun, practical, and relatable, mindfully infused inspiration, insights, and information that you can directly apply in your life, family, and school or business. So, let's get started. Hey there, and welcome to Mindful Living with me, your host, Athea Davis. You are listening to episode 119, Self-Reliance, Retreat, and Inner Power, with my special guest today, David Gessner. If you have been listening to the podcast for a while, you likely know how much I love nature. I'm a huge advocate of getting outside, getting in nature in some way, whether it's a park or a walk in your neighborhood or going out to a national park or a state park or wherever you can get in nature. It is healing. It's rejuvenating. It is another way we can tune in to our mindfulness practices. And in fact, it's one of my favorite ways to have mindful moments. Oftentimes, I love to take walks and runs and hikes when I can in nature. I call it my meditation in motion. And when I've been around a lot of people for quite some time, and as a mindfulness educator, I'm around so many people during the week, my retreat is to get outside. And again, whether that is, I can't always make it to the mountains since I live in Houston. I'm not around any mountains, but I can get outside in my neighborhood and walk my dog or go for a run and or sit in my backyard on a nice day, you know, when it's not too cold. We don't have that issue here in Houston, but or too hot, I should say, too. There are no mosquitoes. We do have to contend with those in the summertime. But just trying to find these little ways to get outside, to heal and rejuvenate and really tap into that inner spark, that inner power. So I'm super excited to have David on the show because he is a nature writer. And I will tell you a little bit about David in just a moment. But what you're going to find in this episode is you're going to learn about David and his journey into becoming a nature writer. We're going to talk about his new book. He has a new book that came out earlier this year, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight, Sheltering with Thoreau in the Age of Crisis. We talk about COVID-19, self-reliance, and the environment, the concept of rewilding, the healing power of nature, and finding solace in your own backyard oasis, and so much more. If you are finding yourself at the end of this, another incredible yet challenging, like, I guess in a sense, seismic shifting is what I've been saying. It feels like we're going through a seismic shift in so many ways. If you've been finding yourself drained or just overwhelmed or a lack of clarity, and you're looking at new tools or just new ways to, you know, tune into you, your inner power, your best self, your bright light inside, where you feel most clear and steady, and you have those calm vibes on. You're in that state of equanimity, you know, no judgments of this is good or bad, but you know what? You're there, what I tell my students, riding the middle wave. You are going to love this episode because there's so much information about. Again, you know, we talk about self-reliance and retreating outside and finding our inner power. You're going to find a lot of inspiration. And let me give you a little intro about David. So David Gessner is the author of Leave It As It Is, A Journey Through Theodore Roosevelt's American Wilderness and the New York Times best-selling All the Wild That Remains, Edward Abbey, Wallace Stegner, and the American West. He's the chair of the Creative Writing Department at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and founder and editor-in-chief of Ecotone. Gessner lives in Wilmington, North Carolina, with his wife, the novelist Nina Day Grammont, and their daughter Hadley. How has the tragic experience of COVID-19 changed the way we live and the way we want to live for those of us lucky enough to have made it through? When the pandemic struck, acclaimed nature writer David Gessner turned to Henry David Thoreau, the original social distancer, for insights in a wide-ranging conversation across the centuries. The resulting book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight, Sheltering with Thoreau in the Age of Crisis, is a lyric yet urgent meditation on life and this earth, which includes lessons about rediscovering our own backyards, self-reliance, and rewilding, the last especially poignant after a year of environmental healing. Okay, well, without further ado, I know you're going to just love this episode. You're going to find it incredibly, I think, healing and something that many of us may be needing right now if you're not already walking walking on this journey of tuning into a little bit more solitude in nature, adding those things in to your routine, to your life, and to your family's life. All right, you're listening to episode 119 here on Mindful Living with Athea Davis, Self-Reliance, Retreat, and Inner Power with my special guest, nature author, David Gessner. Enjoy, and I will see you on the flip side. Well, I want to welcome you, David, to Mindful Living with Athea Davis. Happy you're here today.
Thank you, Athea. I'm really happy to be here.
All right. So there are a couple of quotes that I really connect to, Thoreau quotes. And since you've just recently written a book, I, of course, have to pull the one that I suppose you were inspired to title your book from. So the massive men lead lives of quiet desperation. And I want to dive into that first. So can you, what does that mean to you when you hear those words of Thoreau, the massive men lead lives of quiet desperation?
First, I want to thank you for asking a question no one's asked during months of doing interviews. So I really appreciate it. To me, it means lives that we haven't thought deeply about, that we haven't, I had both the curse and I guess the blessing of doing way too much thinking when I was a teenager. As mm-hmm. you know, like the first line in the book is me taking my daughter on my shoulders to Walden Pond and pointing to the foundation and saying, that's where the man lived who ruined daddy's life. And I say ruined in a good way, but I did way too much thinking. And one of the things I thought a lot about was what I wanted to do with the next 50 years. And I thought maybe too much about it, tying myself in knots. And the idea of becoming a writer was part of that, but also trying to live in a way, maybe pushed a little by Thoreau, where, as Robert Frost famously said, my avocation and vocation were united, like where mm-hmm. I did what I loved. As it turned out, that meant about 15 years of banging my head against the wall, working as a carpenter, working in bookstores, and having some career frustration early on. As it's turned out, it's been a wonderful thing, but it took a long time to get to this wonderful thing. And as I tell my writing students, ingraining that daily discipline of writing, of work, of thinking, isn't easy. If it was mm-hmm. easy, everybody would do it. And yeah. it's something where it's paid off for me. In fact, I really appreciate the question because I haven't said this out loud before, but I guess I'm bearing the fruits of having, that period early on. But I think a lot of us kind of go where we just happen to go. And I'm not claiming some great superiority, though mm-hmm. Thoreau kind of does, doesn't he? He yeah. says, I have thought about is, and this is how I'm going to live, and you idiots haven't thought about it. There's something a little bit didactic about the way Thoreau presents it. But I do think, you know, anything that nudges us to giving more deep thought to the way we live is a wonderful thing. And so that's the first part of the quote, and the second is savage delight, which is a whole different thing.
Well, I certainly agree. I think, you know, it's very uncomfortable that we have these, meaning it's very uncomfortable to dive into yourself and to dive into all the thoughts that we think and to make sense of, you know, meaning of, you know, the human spirit, you know, our common humanity. Yes. So it is uncomfortable. It is much easier to not go, like you said, in that direction and just go about your daily life. I'm so curious, you know, your formative years, what led you to read Thoreau? What led you to, were you just born? Did you have this personality trait that you were just wired a deep thinker? Or was there some person, a teacher, a parent, an experience that led you to read this and feel very connected to this kind of work?
That's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of our, a lot of us are forced around sophomore year English to at least dip into it, right? And, mm-hmm. and Emerson and, so I was forced, but I also had a wonderful teacher in high school, Diane Mead, sophomore year of high school, who was just made literature come alive. And when I read his passages at the moment, I was questioning my own drive. I had kind of a type A father who was, you know, would say, what happened to the other 2 points when I got a 98 on a test? And so kind of ingrained in me was this drive toward achievement, which I wish had diminished more than it has. It's still mm-hmm. there. But so in a way, Thoreau, my dad was a blunt businessman with a very authoritative voice. In a way, Thoreau provided a voice equally confident that clashed up against him. And so on the first page of my book, I quote, "The life that men praise and call successful is but one kind." And this was a revelation for me, the idea that you didn't have to be an all-A student, you know, a successful straight arrow person, and you could have an interesting life. So I don't know how deep a thinker I was, but I started keeping journals. And in fact, those early journals are incredibly superficial. I have them up here. I have like 62 journals. They started when I was 16, and they talk about the crush I had on a girl at school and yeah. The first time I got high, which I won't let my daughter read, you know, and things like that. So only gradually did the journals get a little deeper. But I think habit is the real question, right? William James and whether willpower really exists, whether you can kind of change the raw material you start with. Mm-hmm. And I think to a degree you can through habit. And one of my habits was journal keeping. And the other was reading for how to live. I mean, I've tried to write books that are based on that. I had a biographer, friend, teacher in college, Walter Jackson Bate, who stressed that biography was this great art because we could read it and steal habits for our own lives and how to live our own lives. And that's been a lifelong habit of mine to read biography and try to cobble together my own self out of other selves.
But it almost sounds like too, what you're saying is that you had a natural curiosity to find, to discover what other people were doing, how they were living, what you could learn from them. I'm curious about your teacher, Mead. It's Mead, not yes. Reed, but Mead. Did she inspire the journal writing? Did you just feel compelled one day and said, you know, I'm going to get a journal and start writing? And there it was.
Yeah. I don't remember. And okay. I do know that it was my normal journals, I'm actually using them to hold up the computer right now. They're 8.5 by 11, you know, and you learn gradually. Well, here's one with just some caricatures and some.
Yeah.
You know, you learn to write without lines, but the first ones were kind of little silly journals that I think I just did by myself at first, because I always drew, right? So I was a cartoonist for, and so they kind of just evolved out of that. And it's funny how talking to yourself is a kind of art in its own way, right? You learn to have dialogues with yourself, and they, like anything else, if you do it more, you become more sophisticated at it.
Well, I love journal writing. I'm so curious about your own journal writing. If you do a different, if you have a particular style, I just really like to do, I read The Artist's Way many years ago, and I really connect with the style of just stream of consciousness, kind of just dumping out whatever is on my mind. Exactly. And then I might say something profound in the midst of something, 20 pages later in the journal, not in one sitting, but I've been journal writing for quite some time and find it very, very helpful in terms of getting clarity on my mental state, emotional state, goals, what's working, what's not working. It's your best friend that doesn't talk back.
And mine parallels yours in a couple ways. I mean, you've probably read Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott. And she talks about writing shitty first drafts, which is basically a way of loosening up yourself and not being hypercritical. Mm. So for me, once I decided I wanted to be a writer, I made a big mistake. I didn't write. I just theorized about writing during college. And then I decided, okay, I'm graduated from college. I'm going to write the great American novel. Of course, it's going to be a novel because that's the big ambitious thing to do. Mm-hmm. And my first couple novels, which I worked hard at, were pretty bad. And the dialogue was kind of stilted. I joked that our characters would quote Thoreau to each other. But while I was doing this kind of type A work up here, my journals were continuing. And I feel like that's where my real voice was developing. And when I finally did publish my first book, it was nonfiction. And I thought I was using my journal voice. The other big thing that happened with journals for me was I went to Houghton Library at Harvard and saw Ralph Waldo Emerson's journal. And they bring it up from the subterranean place it's stored and put it on a foam wedge in front of you. And you can only touch the pages with rubber gloves. And it was so perfectly written and it was so thought out. And there was an index at the back and it made me never want to keep a journal again because it was too perfect and it was intimidating. So the freeing moment for me with my journals, when I said anything goes in here, noting the weather, what my emotional state is, cartoons, pictures of trees and birds. Yeah. And I started to call it my swill bin, basically anything. And that freed me up. And that's where I feel like eventually my own voice started to develop from.
Do you have a certain amount of time that you spend each day or do you do it daily? Do you suggest like to your students to adopt a journal practice? And I'm asking for those listening that maybe have never tried journal writing, are curious about it, they've heard about it, and they want to try to adopt a habit, a healthy habit that could, bring ease to their emotional state or ease to their mind or help them in their writing endeavors. What would you suggest as a practice?
Well, let me say what I do and then suggest something slightly different. I have two parts to my writing day. One is in this room I'm sitting in right now, which is my office. It's sloppy, but it's my office. Mm-hmm. And that's a very driven, I have lots of projects and deadlines and I get up early and I do it every day. And I mean every day, holidays, Saturdays, Sundays. And one of the reasons I do that, and I tell my students, and by the way, I'm happy to send along this thing I just published, which is a one-page, all my writing tips, kind of. And one of the biggest words there is momentum. So I do it every day because I do feel, as I say to my students, it doesn't have to be late October and rainy and listening to Neil Young.
The perfect timing, yeah.
You can be inspired on a regular basis. If you have a disciplined time, you do it. And I really believe that. Like I get up, coffee doesn't hurt. But other than that, right. it's the time of day. So that's my regular writing schedule. In the evenings, and this is a big part of the book, just as the journals were kind of a counterlife to my novels I was writing, mm-hmm. the shack where I go down on the edge of my property, you know, it's less than an acre, but it's along a salt marsh, and I built it myself, a little tiny cabin without electricity. And I go down there and I birdwatch, drink a beer, scribble in the journals when it comes. The whole point of the journals for me is not to have a regular time, for it to kind of go by inclination. That being said, what I would suggest for people who want to make it their main thrust is to combine those two things I just described. You know, if you're a morning person, you're a morning person. If you're a night person, you're a night person. But find a time away from people where you can regularly scribble in those pages of the journal and not judging them at all. You know, if nothing comes for a couple weeks or longer, so be it. But just to get into the momentum and the habit of putting pen to paper, or, it's amazing the power of, you know, the famous sentence, it's better to walk in the wrong direction than stay still.
Yeah, I love that. I love how you described your two different environments and how they primed you to be, or maybe you're priming those environments or priming your mind to be in those different states, right? You get up in the morning, you're in your office, you have all your books there. This is audio only, so people aren't seeing you on video, but you have books in the background, and that signals to your brain, I'm ready to write, because you've developed this habit over time, and it gives you that energy and that focus. Whereas in this cabin, you just have a different energy there. You're like, you know what? Instead of coffee, I'm having a beer. And if I want to, I'm just going to scribble out whatever comes to my mind.
Exactly.
And what is, you know, though those two situations are unique, there's a common theme here, is that you have this element of solitude. And And so go ahead.
And I think, in a way, Thoreau, or Montaigne also, who's writing in the 16th century in France, but they're both retirees, even though they're not old enough to retire, but what they've done is retire from the world. And I think Thoreau, in a way, is the patron saint of people who retire or quit or move back from the world. Mm-hmm. And we think of that as a easy, almost indolent thing. But as people who really retire know, it's not. You've got mental challenges in that regard too. And one of my favorite things that Thoreau talks about is how when you go for a walk in the woods, if you are thinking village thoughts, you're not really in the woods. If you're thinking about your things to do list, if you're thinking about what you've got to, you know, do that afternoon, you're not really where you are. And that's not an easy thing, to be out in nature and focused on nature, not on yourself.
Right,
not
to be present nature, just, to that, yeah.
Yeah, and I do feel like, I mean, I actually just got in an argument with somebody about the present moment, and this may rub, you know, given the title of the show, might seem like I'm not in keeping with that, but here's what I was saying is that, first of all, being in the present moment is just, as I described writing or journal keeping, it's a discipline, right? Mm-hmm. And also some of my best moments are in the present when they're informed by the past and the future. And I'm not looking for just, like, for instance, here's a classic example. One way I can be in the woods when I'm in the woods is I'm a birder. Not a birder like a list keeper, but a watcher of birds. And by being engaged in their lives, it's exciting, and it's intellectually stimulating as well as physically pleasurable. And one of the things I talk about in the book is phenology, which Thoreau excelled at, which is the watching of phenomenon during the year and starting to learn them. When things bud, when migrations come through. When my wife and I lived on Cape Cod, we'd been there a couple of years, and I was walking on the beach in October, and I came home and I said to her, the seals should be back soon, because they migrate to Maine and the cold waters in the summer and come back. And the next day they were back, and it was like I'd gotten a promotion at work. I felt like, oh, I'm in sync with the seasons now. I'm starting to get the phenology of the place. And Thoreau did that to such a degree in his journals that climate scientists use them today, comparing them to where things flower and when things bud in Concord, Massachusetts.
You've built that habit of noticing, right? So when we do become present and we're practicing present moment awareness, it is a discipline. It is building the habit of noticing in your environment. And you've done that over time to be able to build that pattern that you've seen with animals or with birds or whatever, whatever it is that you're choosing to anchor your mind on in that moment, in that environment.
It's important to say too, that I fail a lot at it as much as I.
Yeah.
One of my favorite lines recently, particularly when we've been so quick to criticize others and I won't say cancel others, but to attack others, is one of my favorite lines, which is kind of the opposite of that, is this minister came up to Samuel Johnson, the 18th century writer, and Johnson was kind of this wise figure, older, and the minister said to him, "I feel so bad. I have all these impure thoughts troublesome thoughts." And Johnson said, "Well, 2/3 of my thoughts are like that." Basically saying we're all messed up, and it just seems we're forgetting that. And so one of my favorite quotes is from it plays a big part in the book, is from my mentor who just died at 92 a couple of months ago, Reg Sonner in Colorado. And his line was, "We humans are an elsewhere." Almost by evolution and by the way we've had to be, we're always thinking ahead or looking back. And so, again, it's a discipline to not be an elsewhere. And it's not easy. So if you think it's easy and then you fail to do it, you start beating yourself up.
Yeah.
How do we understand that we're just these flawed, messed up creatures and who have good moments and glimpses of behaving well?
And I'm happy you share that because, I think it's important that we share that we don't have it all together. It's okay. We're not going to be perfect at it, Exactly. I want to talk a little bit about the other part in your title of your book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight, Sheltering with Thoreau in the Age of Crisis. Let's look at that phrase, Savage Delight. Why?
Yeah. Well, maybe this is a good segue from talking about disciplined present moments to unexpected, surprising, thrilling present moments, which.
All right. I like
for
that.
For me, well, we had a pregame discussion, and I mentioned seeing the flash flood in Utah coming down the valley. Now, this was a terrible thing for the people who lived there. It was a tragedy, and it was also a riveting, exciting thing, even for many of them, even as they felt fear, because it was this, chocolate sludge carrying trees and boulders coming down the valley. William James, after he was in the famous San Francisco earthquake and fire, and he said it was horrible, tragic, but there was a moment where he felt alive like he hadn't felt before. And if we think about those moments in our lives when we feel really most alive, without trying, without discipline, often they have to do with the physical world, with for me, they have to do with nature. I remember walking on that same beach I described on the Cape Cod beach when I saw gannets, northern gannets, these big white birds diving down for fish and splashing upward. And then I saw something else splashing upward, and it was a humpback whale coming up through. And it was just like, for that, however long, minute and a half, it was just this kind of moment of I don't want to say transcending, because it really uprooting, kind of a feeling part of the physical world. And to me, that's part of what savage delight is. It's the ineffable, it's beyond words. I'm a writer.
Yeah.
I spend all my time with words. how nice to have a break from words, even if it's for a short glimpse.
Indeed.
And so that's what, you know, that's the Savage Delight part for me. And it's something Thoreau celebrated and made a priority in his life. I mean, he would get out into the woods. He would study these things, and he was scientific in a way, but he was also had that kind of visceral pull toward the wild.
And I think that's great information too, that story that you share, how important it is to kind of get out of our shell, get out of, you know, like what's comfortable, to, you know, have some novelty, some adventure, you know, in our life, so we can access the ineffable. We can access what you are calling that savage delight. I think you also use a term, and maybe this is different, you know, sort of like rewilding ourselves.
Yeah. Well, first, I wanted to, you know, Henry Beston was a writer who tried to kind of recreate Thoreau's experience in the dunes of Cape Cod a half century later. And he has a great line, which is, "The world today is sick for lack of elemental things, fire, water, wind," you know, and I really think that's true. But rewilding, which I guess someone was telling me the other day, there's some politically incorrect connotation of it, but that's not how I'm using it here, is the idea that we can take places that have been environmentally devastated or overdeveloped and create wilderness out of them. And the classic example that I know of is called Y2Y, Yellowstone to the Yukon. And it's a joint Canadian-American endeavor. And what they've done is created a migratory corridor going up through Canada to the Yukon, where, for instance, they bought up millions of acres of land, but they've also, when big carnivores might run into a highway, they've vegetated overpasses and underpasses so animals can migrate through those. And to me, that's a thrilling idea. And that's one of the ideas in the book. I break the book up into months, and I put the COVID deaths at the beginning of each month. And the first month is really about learning our backyard. And the second starts to go into rewilding, which, we all saw online when we saw suddenly people in villages who'd never seen that the Himalayas were there could see the mountains because the air was clear. We saw all these examples. And for me, the favorite, I used to live in Boulder, Colorado. And for me, one of the favorite images I saw were the two mountain lions strolling down Main Street in Boulder during the snowstorm. And that's, talk about savage delight. There's a thrill, this idea that maybe we haven't ruined this earth completely. Maybe nature really is resilient and can come back. And I think that moment where we were suddenly all inside and not flying and driving, gave us a little glimpse of what could be, you know, if we let things alone and didn't incessantly build and destroy, which seems to be what we do.
Yeah, speaking of, you know, this idea of this sheltering in the age of crisis, and here we are, you know, still within the pandemic. Now there's a new variant.
Right.
I want to shift and talk about, you know, COVID-19 and the environment, which you've already, you've already talked a little bit about, but I want to focus on this idea of what it means to be self-reliant and why that's important and how that connects to the environment and this idea of rewilding. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the book came about, I wrote the book during COVID, kind of on the heels of experience, and published it almost immediately afterward, which is kind of nuts when you think about it, because usually when I hand in a book, it comes out 2 years later, not 2 months later. So, but the experience, it just seemed to me, and to a lot of other people too, that what Thoreau was doing by supposedly retreating to Walden was very similar to what we were doing, which was suddenly we weren't seeing as many people. We were exploring our backyards. We were by being forced to be more self-reliant and to move around, to be less of an elsewhere, right? So to me, it's suggested that this might be something that we needed to learn, because it's not just this crisis or the Delta variant, or it's the crises to come, which seem to be coming fast and furious. Mm-hmm. I will say that I happened to be reading a biography of Thoreau before the pandemic hit, and rebuilding my writing shack, which had been destroyed in Hurricane Florence. And Laura Walls has a great line, which is, he didn't go to Walden to escape the world, but confront it. And I think that's very important to distinguish between retreat in all its connotations and, you know, and self-reliance, what you're calling self-reliance, which mm-hmm. is, you know, you can go into your own world and you still have your neighbors, you still have your family, you still have, so it's not entirely selfish. And I think that one of the fascinating things that started to happen during the year for us, and which happened to Thoreau at Walden, is the things you create in solitude and self-reliance, the things you make there, you can bring back to the world. Famously, what Thoreau brings back is Civil Disobedience, the essay in his political writing, which I have a long section of Martin Luther King writing in his autobiography, basically saying, this is what influenced me in the 60s. This is what I used as a model for the sit-ins and the marches. And he really goes over the top in saying, Thoreau more than anybody else did this. So isn't that kind of fascinating that somebody goes away from the world, you know, thinks and creates and brings back something that so impacts the world? And that became the strangest thing about the year for me, the way it was the most private year and the most public year, the most internal year and the most external. Right. And how bizarre it was, like, for me to be listening to the clapper rails, the birds behind my shack, and taking note of them, and then come up to the house where CNN was on, and just always feeling kind of these two poles of the interior and the exterior. And of course, with the election year, you just had this constant noise and chaos and daily anxiety attacks that were the opposite of what Thoreau did at Walden and retreat. But one of my students said, there's never been a time of such racial tension. And my colleague, Clyde Edgerton, who's a Southern novelist, said, well, there was the Civil War. And Thoreau is writing, really, you know, some people think of the John Brown Rebellion as the beginning of the Civil War, even though it's a couple of years before. Thoreau is writing right at that moment of intense conflict and political turmoil. And he's refusing to pay his taxes because they're going to support slavery and the Mexican War. So it's just an interesting example of how you can both be interior and self-reliant and still be involved with the world. And I think that was another part of the year for all of us, that dual nature of it.
Yeah, it's certainly really powerful, you know, the stories that you share in that. And I've heard so many conversations from just people of all different backgrounds, really connecting to the power that there is in the self-reliance, in the retreat, in the, I didn't even know, you know, that I felt this way or thought this way because I was just going about leading lives of quiet desperation. And then I had this forced opportunity to slow down, to retreat, and many people coming out of that with, you know, a rebirthing in a sense. Oh, I realized that, you know, maybe they didn't create some famous speech, or maybe they did, but I realized this job wasn't for me. So now I'm going to do something else. Or, wow, I realized how I love to journal, write. I never did that before, but all these just different connections to who you are as what I've often said on this show, like your bigger self, your higher self, really connecting to that inner space.
I love that. It's funny because we talked before we started the interview. I just came off a month and a half of promoting the book. And there's always an irony. I wrote a book about being solitary and deep. And so I ran around everywhere and was superficial and fast. But I came home and I really thought, okay, I wrote this book. Now what if I actually listened to what I wrote? And one of the, you know, and I've kind of made a list of what that meant. And for me as a writer, and these are, you know, applicable to people in different fields. For me as a writer, it means valuing the writing and the process more and the publishing less. Mm. After a month of posting every damn talk or article I was in, it means let's have a moratorium on any self-promotional promoting on posting on yeah. Facebook or whatever. And I thought, and it means slowing down, which again, just like I said about being in the present moment, is a discipline. There's a moment in the book where I'm watching a great blue heron as it fishes. And it's still, and it's still, and it's still, and then it strikes the fish. And I think I say something like, you know, it's not being patient because it's a nice state to be in. It's being patient because it's effective. You know, it's a way to, it's an art to hold mm. back and be still and restrain yourself. It's an art that I'm naturally not very good at, but I, you know, I, so basically I'm coming into this new year. Who knows if we're going to be at home again at this rate. I teach supposedly starting in mid-August, my classes start, but I really want to put my money where my mouth is to be inelegant about it and listen to what I was saying last year and try to slow it down. And that's what, I think that's what you're saying about if you take enough time to really think about this stuff, maybe you can actually live that larger life that you mentioned.
Yeah, and I love the term that, I think you use this term backyard oasis. So for those that can't, you know, just because of obligations or you just can't make it work to, you know, go on an outside adventure or you don't live in a place, you know, that you can access, you know, a mountain or near the sea or a lake or something like that. I think there's a lot that you can just do with retreating within the space that you have, that you can create within your own home or having your own backyard oasis.
Another thing that goes with that is some of us got to know our neighbors a little better by our immediate neighbors. And, mm-hmm. and another kind of cliche of Thoreau is that he's this hermit. Two cliches. One is that he was supposedly going off into the wilderness. And he knew Concord. He knew Walden Pond was a short walk to Concord Center. He did go bring his laundry home on Sundays, and he gets a lot of flack for that. But he never thought he was John Muir out in California climbing a tree during a thunderstorm. He knew it was an intellectual adventure, but he also was a good neighbor. And he took the kids in the neighborhood on huckleberry adventures, collecting huckleberries, and taught them the names of trees and birds. So neighborliness was a factor in my year too. And as it happened, my neighbor, who's my friend, also voted for a different presidential candidate than I voted for. Mm-hmm. And since I'm a liberal college professor, you can probably guess who I voted for. And then after, the next day after the election, very different than what was happening on our televisions, he left a six-pack of IPA on my doorstep and wrote, "To the victor go the spoils," reaching out from the other side of the Great Divide. Mm. So it's not always as simple, you know, as it's portrayed on television. And to me, that was a very hopeful moment during the year.
I love that. I love that you share that. And it reminds me of another Thoreau quote. It doesn't matter what you see, it's how you see it.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
I love that too. I mean, and you have to kind of knock yourself out of your normal life, like you suggested, to start seeing things a little differently.
Mm.
There are all sorts of ways to do that. Some legal, some not.
Indeed, David. I want to transition. It's been so awesome to rapid fire. And then I want to talk about where people can buy your book, connect with you, all of that good stuff. And my rapid fire, just ask these big life questions. Whatever word or phrase comes to your mind, that's how you answer. And if you get no answer at all, that's an answer too.
Okay.
All right. No pressure though. Just for fun. Rapid fire question number one. What do you believe?
In our animalness.
What are you grateful?
That's what came to mind. I'm sorry.
I love it. No, I mean, I love it. In our animalness. I like that.
Animality? I don't know what the word is.
In our wildness? I don't know. What are you grateful for?
Being a dad, I think.
Mm. What sustains you?
My writing really sustains me.
And you are on Mindful Living with Athea Davis, so I like to ask all my guests on this show. So, David, what does Mindful Living mean to you?
Thinking woods thoughts in the woods, not village thoughts.
I like that. Let's talk about your new book. All right. So you have this new book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight. Why should people be reading this right now? Where can they buy a copy? Where can they connect with you online, et cetera?
I think they should be reading it. Well, for one thing, it's published by the literary equivalent of a microbrewery, Torrey House Press, which my previous book was with Simon and Schuster. It was a bigger book about Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. These guys have been great, and they were flexible in the way no big press could be. And it's the first, I think it's the first thoughtful book about the pandemic, written immediately as the pandemic was happening. It can be found anywhere books are found, though, because it's a Western smaller press, probably, you know, online is probably the surest way to get it, mm-hmm. whether that means, I won't even mention the Death Star of Amazon, but there are many other smaller venues. Probably the easiest way to, you know, my website is davidgessner.net, and I used to post quite a lot on something called Bill and Dave's Cocktail Hour, which was a fellow writer friend of mine, Bill Rohrbach's. But if you, you know, just throw my name in the Google machine and a couple things will come up. I tweet a little, but I'm going to try to tweet less, or just friend me on Facebook at David Gessner, because that's the old person's venue and that's where I mostly am.
Okay. Sounds awesome, David. Thank you so much for being on the show today. Definitely go get a copy of Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight. And thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and I have enjoyed our conversation and all the work that you do in your writing. So thank you.
And thank you for asking questions nobody else asked in the last couple of months. It was refreshing and a pleasure.
Awesome. Hey there, and welcome back to the flip side of my conversation with David Gessner. You have been listening to episode 119, Self-Reliance, Retreat, and Inner Power with my guest, as I said, David Gessner. If you enjoyed this episode, please do me a favor. Go to iTunes and give me a rate and review. It makes the world of difference, letting me know that you enjoy the guests that I'm bringing on this show and the content that I'm bringing your way, that it makes a difference for you. So love the feedback, all the good, bad, and ugly, and in between. So always have room to grow as well and open to your thoughts and ideas. Tell me what you like, what you would like to hear more of. Would really appreciate it, and only takes a couple of minutes. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure you screenshot it and share it on your favorite social media platform and tag me at Athea Davis and tag David Gessner. I will make sure to link his social media handles in the show notes. And make sure you're following me on social media. I am on all the places and spaces. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, at Athea Davis. That's A-T-H-E-A-D-A-V-I-S, at Athea Davis. I am always sharing lots of mindful living content. That's a big umbrella. So I talk about a lot of different things out there on social as it relates to mindfulness in schools or being a mindful parent or the healing power of nature, spirituality, health, wellness, all kinds of things to help you optimize in mind, body, and spirit. And I would love to connect with you, be friends with you, see what you're up to in the world, and would love for you to just follow along, follow my journey along, or follow along with my journey, if I get that right. Come on, Athea. Follow me along on my journey. That's what I'm meant to say. Sometimes when I record and I have too much caffeine, things get intermixed here with my words, get a little tongue-tied, don't we all, right? But I would love to connect with you, so make sure to give me a follow, and I hope you're doing well as we close out this incredibly, another incredibly challenging year. Also, I'm sure you've had many joys and successes along the way, but there's no doubt that we are in some seismic shift here culturally as we come out of this pandemic that we are still all in. And we're looking at new ways of living, new ways of being, new ways of doing. And I hope that as you take a little internal inventory in your own life, that you will put some nature time, outside time, into your schedule as a new way of being and doing and getting all of those great benefits for your mind, body, and spirit, putting yourself out there and in nature, in the park, whatever you love to do. That's important. It's important to find what you love to do, because that's where you're going to go back over and over to get your rejuvenation. And it's been a pleasure. It was great to have David on to give us some insights and inspiration. Be sure to check out his new book, Quiet Desperation, Savage Delight. I will also link that in the show notes. And I'm voting your victory out there. I hope that you are tuning in to your own inner power and appreciate you as a listener. And if you enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes, please share with a family member or a colleague or a friend that you think would gain some value from listening to Mindful Living with Athea Davis. Thank you so much. And I'm sending you all the love and all the awesome sauce flair. I will see you in the next episode. Bye for now. Thank you for listening to the Mindful Living Podcast with me, your host, Athea Davis. Think of me as your extra sparkly, good vibes, and no-nonsense guide, reminding you to take intentional action and choose to be the person today you want to become tomorrow. The world needs your sparkle, your joy, your gifts in action. Speaking of, I have a free gift for all my podcast listeners. Go now and subscribe to my email list and get your free health and wellness guide, Awesome Sauce Insights, at soulscentsyoga.com. And take a moment to rate and review my podcast on iTunes or wherever you may find yourself listening to Mindful Living with Athea Davis. I truly appreciate your time and feedback so I can continue to deliver valuable content to each of you. Until next time, have an awesome sauce day, friends.